Hello, Matt.
Welcome to the DMC post Thanksgiving edition. Thanksgiving seems like it was an eternity ago, Bill. And yet, just a few days ago, right?
Well, I'm still eating turkey pot pie, so it's not quite over for me.
It's like a week.
My wife thankfully made 6 turkey pot pies with the leftovers. Which we've had 2 of so far, and got 4 in the freezer. So I endorse this new tradition.
You can ship some of those down to Southern DMZ anytime.
Now, how was Thanksgiving with the newborn?
It was great. It was great. Having kids does have some benefits. It's an argument to get out of jail card for a lot of stuff. I'd love to go to this event, but you know we've got that little one at home now. So it's an excuse to force family to come to your house. So we don't play road games, Bill. We only play home games. And so you can come.
We're in the same boat.
You come to my house.
But that puts some burden on you to do the work. You got to host.
Well, there is some work to it, but I control the means of production. And you can time everything so the people were leaving just as the Redskins were beginning to defeat the Cowboys. So I could enjoy that. So there's a little bit of a downside to it, but mostly a benefit to play house.
There's still that pressure to everything go on time requires the turkey being done on time, and this has always befuddled us for years. This is the first year, and this is credit to my wife, we got the thermometer in the right part of the leg. So it actually it cooked on time, and we knew it was cooked on time.
My wife is
My wife's
a foodie, and she does this thing with the turkey. She doesn't do the old school thing where you kind of keep the turkey together and you cook it for like 7 hours or something. She cuts it and open, and it cooks for like an hour or something. And I don't know what that's called, but according to her, it's the wave of the future.
Did she spatchcock it?
Sounds dirty.
That was the hip thing this year, spatchcocking.
So this year, though, it was great because we also, because we just had a baby, you know, my wife made the turkey, and then we forced others to kind of chip in and bring stuff. And we bought some stuff, had some stuff catered, too. So we didn't have the huge burden of preparing an entire Thanksgiving meal. We just kind of had to pick up the house a little bit, you know?
I know. All too well.
And the fact that the Redskins beat the Cowboys made it, you know, a very good Thanksgiving, I should say.
So despite the holiday season, politics is not taking a break. There's all sorts of legislation, legislative jockeying around the deficit talks, but we'll save that for a little bit. I wanted to start with the 2016 jockeying, which also no one's taking a break from that. It seems strictly in the Republican side. I feel the Democrat side is a little quieter right now. There's chatter about Hillary and Biden and Andrew Cuomo, but you're not seeing a lot of big speech making or strategic interview making or anything like that. Whereas you're seeing, I think, more stuff on the right. And this week, both Jeb Bush and Chris Christie. And Newt Gingrich were in the headlines. We might not be finished with Newt yet. What is the right thinking about the various moves these three are making?
Well, I don't know that I can speak for this monolithic group on the right, especially right now because the opinions are so divided. But I'll give you my take on all of it.
It's less and less monolithic.
I'm happy to give you my take on it. Christie is incredibly popular in New Jersey, but I still think that he has really hurt himself nationally.
But isn't it fair to say that at this point, the most well-known Republican figure right now is Chris Christie?
You could certainly argue that. You could certainly make that that argument, and probably the most popular within his own state. But
it's a blue state. I mean, they aren't these big selling points.
Yeah, it could be. It could be a good selling point. It depends, I think, how desperate Republicans get and how demoralized this 2012 loss makes them. I mean, so I think that, for example, Bill Clinton was able to use the fact that he was a new Democrat from a southern conservative state as an argument to buttress his nomination in 92. But Romney wasn't able to do the same thing. I mean, he obviously got the nomination, but I don't think it was because of the Massachusetts miracle. And so I suppose it's possible that if Republicans were really thinking that they were on the ropes, that they might turn to someone who could say, hey, look, I won in New Jersey. I can win New Jersey. I don't think we're there yet, and I don't think we're going to be there. And I think Christie did himself real damage nationally in terms of winning a Republican primary and winning conservatives with the way that he handled Sandy. And so,
but if that's the main thing, if the main anger is still about you weren't a trustworthy ally in the home stretch of 2012, it shows that you're you put yourself above everybody else and all that kind of thing. I mean, I get why that bruises.
Well, no, but it's kind of a big deal. It's a deal breaker. I mean, it's like saying, yes, she only had sex with your best friend, but otherwise she's a good wife. I mean, it's a big, big deal. And besides, Christie...
But it's not policy. It's not ideology. It's just ambition.
Well...
I mean, so why should that, at the end of the day, if you're going to think Chris Christie's going to sign the bills you like and nominate the judges you like, being a calculating operator in and of itself is a deal breaker? Do you think 4 years out, the memories that will be so strong that it would overwhelm everything else?
Well, I guess a few things. One, it's not like he is a perfect orthodox conservative. There are plenty of questions about his conservative bona fides and his actual appointments and policies that conservatives have largely ignored up until now because they rationalized and justified it by saying, well, yeah, but he's tough and he says mean things about Obama. That covers a multitude of sins, as you know, Bill.
And unions.
Tough. And he takes on the teacher
union. Union bashers, he was a go a long
right,
way, too.
Yeah, and he was very, you know, he's very eloquent at taking on the unions on, say, like Morning Joe, where he's a pretty frequent guest. But having said that, there were already questions about him, and I think that this is a bridge too far. Now, could it be healed over the course of years if he returns to saying mean things about Obama? Maybe. But I think that I think this is a major obstacle now for him, and the fact that he's doing so well in New Jersey should not be taken as a sign that he would do well.
I mean, I would have thought that Romney Care was a deal breaker to win a Republican primary this time around, and maybe it would have been if the conservative part of the field, you know, had some stronger candidates.
Right.
But that's
it precisely. I mean, I think you're exactly right, Bill. I mean, if Mitt Romney were running against Jeb Bush and Mike Pence and Marco Rubio and Rand Paul and Bobby Jindal and Susana Martinez or whomever, it would have been a much bigger deal. And that's the problem for Christie. It's going to be a very strong field.
He's like, he can't clear the field, of course. But the other big name that's coming up now is Jeb Bush. Apparently he had some big meeting with his inner circle. He's clearly doing strategic things to keep his name in the press, but he's also not someone that conservatives are in love with. Is it possible that you're going to get a field of a bunch of people that conservatives don't like?
He could run. It's interesting. Jeb Bush is interesting for a variety of reasons. One, my take is if he wanted to run, it would have been awful nice. And I'll say this about Mitch Daniels, too. I think both are... both are overrepresented. How do I put this? The press loves Mitch Daniels and Jeb Bush the way that they loved John Huntsman. They're disconnected from the conservative base. And as much as some Tea Party and grassroots conservatives may say the same damn thing about me, I think I have a much better feel for the conservative base than a lot of the mainstream.
But Jeb's got more cards to play than Huntsman ever did.
Well, yes, but Huntsman was a very conservative governor and a U.S. ambassador, and so, I mean, it's not like Huntsman was Joe Blow. I mean, Huntsman had quite a good tenure as governor of Utah, and actually, some of his policy proposals running for president were very good. It's his rhetoric and his style that were, you know, very discordant. But if you take aside his rhetoric and his persona, he's a damn good candidate.
But he's still somewhat of an outsider to both the conservative base and the Republican establishment. He was trying to run as more of an outsider type candidate who was going to put a different face and style in the Republican Party. Jeb Bush is the Republican establishment. I mean, the Bush name essentially is defining of the Republican establishment. Even he may not be conservative base. He's going to have plenty of establishment tools in his arsenal to get get press attention, to get money, to get infrastructure, and to get early poll numbers to make him a top tier candidate. Wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. I'm just saying that the conservative base would not be with him, and that.
But conservative base seems to lose Republican establishment presidential primaries almost every time.
You make a good point. Although I think they would argue that they tend to elect presidents.
Well, they have the Reagan card, but
when they nominate them.
But Dole, W. McCain, and Romney, none of those guys were of the conservative movement.
Right. Well, that's a point well taken. But the problem that Bush has, obviously, is that he's a Bush. And even though the funny thing is, apparently, according to legend, Jeb Bush was always the more conservative and the more prepared to be the president. And he lost a race, I think, to Lawton Childs. And if I got that wrong, I'm sure our commenters will tell me that we thought he would win, I think, in 98.
This is when W won in Texas that same year, right?
Was that maybe it was 96, 98, right. Maybe whatever. But George W. Bush surprisingly wins in Texas. I think he beat Ann Richards.
Right,
is that
right?
Right. And so this twist of, you know, fate or whatever, Jeb Bush became president when a lot of people thought Jeb would have been better. And the Bush family always assumed that Jeb, at least according to lore, that Jeb would be president, and it's presumed that he would have been more conservative and more competent. But whatever the case may be, Jeb would be well-financed and well-regarded. My take is, number one, I wish if he wanted to run, it would have been nice if – same thing with Mitch Daniels, by the way. It would have been nice if they did it in 2012. Instead of waiting till now when they can totally step on this fresh crop of up-and-coming, this new generation, this post-Bush generation of conservative rising stars. And Jeb Bush would especially be damaging to Marco Rubio. I suspect that if Jeb gets in, Rubio won't.
You think there's no room for two Floridians?
Well, Jeb's his mentor, and it would be... It would certainly cut into Rubio's appeal and base, and Rubio may conclude that he just would be better off not chancing it if Jeb gets in. So I think I just hope that – here's the other thing that I'm worried about, Bill. People using the electoral process for ulterior motives. So you have people like Donald Trump, who I think sort of teased the press and flirted with running just to get buzz. Not because he was sincere, I don't think, but just to get buzz. You have people like Sarah Palin, who I think teased the press and did this bus tour, and I don't think she was really exploring a run. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe she was, but I suspect it was all sort of a gimmick to get attention and to get buzz. And I think that has consequences. And so if Jeb Bush, as some people have speculated, Ben Dominic and Philip Klein on Twitter, two conservative opinion leaders, sort of implied on Twitter after news broke that Jeb had met with some of his former staffers in D.C. If he is using this to toy with the media to get attention, even if it's for a good cause, to draw attention to his education reform groups or policies or whatever, I think it's damaging because I think, you know, this isn't Hollywood. I mean, these things have consequences. And if Jeb toys too long, it could cause Rubio or Jindal to – even if they don't get out of the race, maybe they can't get money. Maybe donors are on the sidelines hoping Bush gets in. I mean, I know it's really early to be saying this, but at some point this could become a problem.
Well, I mean, there is this sort of pre-primary phase where folks are sort of lining up donors and lining up key operatives. And so I agree with you that, you know, the things start earlier than maybe people realize, but I would think Jeb has some period of time to ponder before completely freezing out other up and comers. I mean, I don't know if he'd have to make an announcement before, early 2014 to not give anyone else a chance to line people up. And certainly if Rubio was wanting it and was concerned about that, presumably if he is a mentor, he has a good relationship to say, hey, you know, I'm not going to do this if you do this, but I need to know by a certain date if I'm going to have a chance myself. I assume you can give Jeb a reasonable date if they are on good terms to make sure that he doesn't step on his toes.
Well, let me ask you, Bill, from your perspective, how would a Jeb Bush candidacy be greeted from the left? I assume that they attempt to tie him to George W.
Yeah, I mean,
talk about the dynasty, but you got the Clinton Bush dynasty could be back. Right?
I mean, it could be Hillary Bush, for Clinton Bush for 2016.
That's gonna be the next Dick Morris book, by the way. Hillary versus Jeb.
I mean, I think the left sometimes makes a mistake of not thinking through, five steps ahead. Obviously, the immediate argument to make is to guffaw and say, another Bush, how many failed Bushes do these guys going to try to put up? But, people said that when W ran the first time, and because his father's tenure was not, he was a one-term president, for Pete's sake, and George W. didn't run too far after that failure. Now you could argue that he didn't actually win, so perhaps it was a good thing to come up. Obviously, it was much closer than people ever thought it would be. And Jeb, obviously, if you've seen him speak, does not come across like really either his father or his brother. There are no weird tics. There's no faux folksiness. There's no actual or manufactured dimwittedness. If he's not maybe an exciting, charismatic speaker, he certainly comes across as hard-headed and competent. So I don't think it would be that hard for him to break out of the Bush stereotype. And what you get with whether you call it a dynasty or call it a brand, the Bush name generally speaks to perhaps a familiarity or a comfortableness, where if there is a desire for something stable, and I mean, who knows what the general mood of the country is going to be 4 years from now, but the Bush name, I think can be rehabilitated, with a guy like Jeb. At least the possibility exists. I wouldn't discount it. I don't think it's going to be that easy to just say everything that George W. did falls on Jeb's shoulders. Jeb could pretty easily take some positions to distinguish himself from that, if his read was he had to do that to show I'm not like my brother. We probably wouldn't put it in those sort of blunt terms, but we would just take the stances to show I'm a different kind of guy, and his demeanor would be very different. So I am
tired. It is amazing how dynastic we are. We just had Mitt Romney, son of George Romney.
That's the lamest dynasty we have. This is the dynasty of losers.
But look, is it unrealistic to suspect that at some point it's going to be George P. Bush versus Tag Romney for the Republican nomination?
Sure.
I mean, this is ridiculous. You know who I respect the Bushes who didn't go into politics. Billy Bush, whoever that model is, or some model who's a Bush. They're my keepers.
Well, look,
stay out the Bushes.
We've not had a Roosevelt run for president in a long time or get involved in elected politics. We haven't had a lot of Carters, you know, jump in. There's been a, I think it was one attempt recently.
Well, the grandson of Jimmy Carter did have an impact.
Yes, yeah, I mean, he's involved.
A major impact.
He's involved,
but a major impact this year.
But I don't think he's looking to run.
27%.
I don't think he's looking to run himself. Amy Carter never ran herself. The Gores are staying out of it, it seems. They seem pretty scarred from the 2000 experience. So there's plenty of families that don't follow suit. But
I just hope that little Beckett and little Burke Lewis – make their old man.
But I think this is a bit mild. But I think it happens because I think people sometimes people get so frustrated that they want the fresh face and the outsider. But those times seem more the exception than the rule. More often I think we gravitate to people who exude some comfort that, you know, they're not going to drive us off the cliff, and a political family that goes by generations, you know, is not going to go off half-cocked.
Well, it is ironic. You know, we fought a war to end this hereditary monarchy or whatever, and then we go to the Kennedys and the Bushes and the Romneys and the Clintons, and it is weird. It's vestigial sort of.
Well, because remember, but Ted Kennedy couldn't really follow through with that hope of dynasty. He got beat by an outsider, although granted it was run for re-election. And you haven't seen a lot of Kennedys in the generation following step up, and they've had so many familial issues that brand name's been been bruised. And now, of course, now you have a 30-something Kennedy who just won a House seat. Massachusetts, so that this brief period of time in Massachusetts where there are no Kennedys in any seat is over. But
this Bush thing, I mean, this goes past Poppy. I mean, this is like Prescott Bush, right? Wasn't he a senator from New England?
Right, from Connecticut, sure.
This could be like four or five, six generations of Bushes, playing prominent roles at national level. Political life.
But considering that there hasn't been any Republican presidential winner without a Bush or Nixon on the ticket since 1952, you actually haven't in recent years we've seen a lot of we have seen new names in the past 20 years. I mean, Clinton's not a dynastic family; he might become one, but he certainly started off coming from any kind of dynasty. He came from
not enough male heirs. Not enough Bill heirs.
Right.
You get my point.
Yeah, yeah.
Now Chelsea, who knows? There was a Politico story about a year ago about Chelsea sort of stepping into the spotlight.
Right.
She was like on some 30 Rockefeller.
Well, she still has an NBC contract. That just was
Rockefeller. Center.
30 Rock, or a Rock Center.
Is that what it's called? Okay.
But there's a news story came out. She wanted to be in some pro-gay marriage as an NBC wouldn't let her. It said it would violate your contract if you do take a political position. So she's had to be a little muted. So maybe she'll chafe at that eventually and break out of it. So some indication that she would like to run. But, you know, our names, Clinton.
And there's always Roger Clinton, too. Is he still around?
Maybe he's going to be on The Voice. But you go back to the 90s, you know, Clinton, Dole, McCain, and Obama, you know, you have a number of names that are not from well-heeled patrician political families. But you also have mixed in there, you have your Bushes and your Romneys and you have Gore. So we have a tier of, you know, people in the business, and we have a tier of people that came out of relative nowhere. And you know that's not bad as far as politics goes. But I don't think you ever extinguish the ability for families to just like you never you're going to have actor families, you're going to have CEO families, you're going to have people who are in the business who are going to hand down their knowledge to the next generation. That's never going to totally go away. But we still have a system that where a Barack Hussein Obama can still break in there.
That's a good point. And look, it's possible we go from a Barack Obama to a Bobby Jindal or from a Barack Obama to a Marco Rubio. And that would be kind of refreshing, I think. So But Jeb Bush could mess that all up.
Now,
we'll see what happens.
The other name that we can't seem to get...
If he's sincere about exploring a run, more power to him. He's certainly qualified. But if he's just toying around, I hope he makes it clear pretty early that he's not going to run.
Now, the other name that's being put out there by himself, which I would not have expected, or perhaps I should have expected, is Newt. I mean, this guy got pretty well humiliated in the 2012 race, but he seems to think he has an opening to say, I even though I'm a guy who's been around for almost 30 years in politics, I have some sort of outsider thinking that is going to refresh the party.
So I don't think Newt is going to run. I think that that Newt is utterly brilliant, but obviously I don't think he I don't think he's going to be president. It is interesting though, Bill. In 2007, when Newt was flirting with this idea of running for president, I went down to Georgia with some of my colleagues, including Robert Bluey and Ed Morrissey, and interviewed Newt. And during the interview with Rob and Ed, I'm going to read to you what Newt told them. This is from 2007, and I think it's pretty prescient. He says, "I think Republican consultants are mostly very stupid. I think they have no education. I think they have no sense of history. If I throw away African Americans, and then I throw away Latinos, and then I throw away suburban women, and then I throw away people under 40, and then I throw away everything north of Philadelphia, there's a morning where Republicans can't get a majority." Now, obviously, Newt's not the first or only person to ever sort of make that point. But if you look at what happened in 2012 and a lot of the postmortem, Newt in 07 was pretty spot on. And as you may recall, he talked about the Hispanic vote. I mean, Newt, got into it with Mitt Romney. And Romney attacked Newt for saying that he wouldn't deport grandmothers who'd been here for decades. So I just found that interesting, that I think that despite the fact that Newt won't be president, shouldn't be president, I think he's a very smart guy who has said some really good things and should be paid attention to. It's ironic, of course, it's interesting that Newt went ahead after that and hired a whole bunch of consultants, and his campaign, got off to a horrible start, and then he got rid of all, or the consultants left him, abandoned him to go to work for Rick Perry, and then Newt resurfaced as a front runner.
But there's another part to that story, though. I mean, he got himself back in the game with his debate performances, which he is an accomplished enough performer that he didn't need a team of consultants to be good in those debates. But because he had no actual political staff to do sort of basic blocking and tackling, he couldn't capitalize on that. I mean, he was barely on the ground in these key states. He just didn't have offices, didn't have people. And he just seemed to thumb his nose at it and think that he was in a sort of post-campaigning era where he could just be on TV and get out the vote. And that was incredibly short-sighted. He missed a massive opportunity.
Yeah, no, it didn't work, wasn't a good idea. But I think he was completely right about what he said. Not just there are a couple of – it's very textured. There are a few layers here that I like that Newt said. First of all, I think he's entirely right about – obviously he's right about when you write off Hispanics and African-Americans and women and, you start writing off all these groups, eventually you can't win. Well, I think he was obviously – predicting something that came true, and he was ahead of the curve in terms of voicing it. But the other thing that is interesting is if you know about political consulting and political strategy, the problem with consultants and the problem with campaigns is that they're short-sighted. So, for example, if you told me that I had to win a presidential election 6 months from now, I probably wouldn't worry about registering voters or bringing new people in because that's too hard. What I would probably do is do what Newt said. Figure out, okay, out of 100% of the population, who is registered to vote? And of the people registered to vote, who is likely to show up? And of the people who are likely to show up, who among them are already with my opponent? And who is already with me? And then you end up with a very small percentage of, you know, 3 to 5% of the population that's registered, likely eligible, and persuadable. They're not for me or my opponent,
right,
that you target in terms of persuasion. Well, that's smart if you're running a campaign in 6 months. It's insanity if you're trying to build a movement or build a party for 5 years from now. And so the incentives for consultants and candidates are entirely different than the incentives of party building and movement building. And that is sort of inherently the problem.
Well, it also depends on what kind of consultant I don't think it's a question of just consultants, period. Like, Obama had consultants. Obama had a campaign team. But they were a team that focused on how do you build a movement block by block? How do you do it in a way that sustains it, is not and actually carries through and expands the electorate come election day? They put a lot of years into that project, and they probably had a good balance of knowing their political history and not being bound by political history, and thinking ahead, and how do you reshape a race for the future? So I don't think it's wrong. It seems short-sighted. All consultants are bad and don't know what they're doing. Maybe a lot do.
And
I think this is true, a lot of consultants get credit where they don't deserve it, because anytime there's a winner, all of a sudden anyone involved in that is treated as a political genius, when there could be all sorts of factors that they have absolutely nothing to do with. And there are people like...
No, I agree with you completely, Bill. I mean, they're good consultants and bad consultants. And everybody, Morton Blackwell, my former boss, wrote a column for the Daily Caller the other day about consultants. And the problem is that essentially the way it works is if you get good at doing campaigns, you can't really make money as a campaign manager. You don't make a lot of money managing races, and it's difficult. You're moving all over the country. You can't really have a family life. And so you become a consultant, and then the more clients you take on, the better, unless you can find, put your star on the wagon of a Barack Obama. But mostly as a consultant, you're balancing multiple candidates, and you have an incentive to encourage TV, because you can either get kickbacks from people who do placement, or if you do TV ad placement, you get like a 15% for placing. If you build a great grassroots operation, you don't get any extra money. So there's an incentive to have a lot of candidates to encourage them to do media instead of grassroots, because grassroots is tough and time intensive. You don't make as much money either. So there's this natural incentive. And so, it starts off as, I don't know what the famous quote, every movement starts off as a movement, turns into a business and ends up as a racket. So if all of these Republican consultants, Bill, who make a ton of money, who essentially are doing this cookie cutter thing for a lot of candidates, and they're not being creative, and they're not worrying about the long run. They're worrying about, how do I just get enough votes, squeeze enough votes to get this guy elected? It's very short term, and they are doing harm to the cause.
Yeah, but I totally agree. I'm sure there is deadwood. I'm sure there are people who were built to win campaigns in a previous era and don't know how to adapt to modern media techniques and current demographic state of the country. I accept all that. I'm sure Republican consulting class needs fresh blood. But is this not true of conservative movement leadership as well? Have they built a model, as the phrase has been bandied about, a conservative entertainment complex model that has kept a constituency very loyal of tens of millions, but is not suitable to go get over that hump and be appealing and open and welcoming to a new generation of folks?
Well, this speaks to what I was talking about with the Jeb Bush thing. If he is, I'm sick of people who are exploiting the political process for selfish reasons. People who, celebrities who, it's like politics has become the new sex tape. You know, it's become dining at the Ivy and hoping the paparazzi catches you. I mean, it's a way to get attention. So you dip your toes in politics, you mess around in it. With that's fine if you are a movie star or an actor, like say George Clooney, who sincerely believes in things and wants to make a difference. That's one thing. But to do it for ulterior motives, I mentioned Palin. You know, I think Palin was a great governor of Alaska. He had an 88% approval rating. I don't think she was sincere about running for president. And the press followed her all over, chased her bus. And I would say the same thing about some conservative media celebrities and pundits who say outrageous things just to get attention and ratings for themselves. But it has dramatic consequences and negative consequences for the conservative movement and the Republican Party. And so I think that, you know, it's time to quit being selfish and to think whether it's Jeb Bush deciding either, you know, to not toy around with it. And again, if he wants to run, more power to him. He's earned that right. I'm just urging people, everybody, to not play around with the political process as a way
you don't want to see the up-and-comers get big-footed.
Yeah, I don't exactly. Look, I want these guys to have a clean shot at this thing. We've got a conservatives have a tremendous opportunity to field some great young up and coming fresh candidates, and I want them to have a clean shot. And look, if somebody who's been around a long time sincerely wants to run, if Mitch Daniels decides to run, I don't think he will, but if he does, more power to him. But just don't mess around with it. Don't block these guys for no reason, and gals too, by the way, because it could be Nikki Haley and Susana Martinez and others.
Now, I would think something that's going to have some bearing on how cohesive the party is going forward is the outcome of these deficit talks, which are coming to a head in a few weeks. There is a sense that there are rifts in the party about taxes, and you know, if some deal is done that goes against, you know, Grover Norquist's orthodoxy, how does that shake up the party, the movement, 2016? If the folks do a deal, and the conservative movement, you know, dislikes it, does that give fuel to a candidate saying, I reject playing footsie with the Democrats and try to channel that anger? Or is the opposite occur and they do a deal and people say, well, that didn't hurt so bad. You know, we can still be Republicans and be conservative and do deals from time to time. And that changes the whole tenor and strategy of the party going forward.
Well, I do want to talk about the politics, but first wanted to bring up, talking about the debt deal, wanted to bring up a couple of interesting things that I think deserve mention that I've written about in recent days. One is the Corker plan, which, you know, Senator Bob Corker has a proposal which would essentially cap deductions at $50,000, but it would also reform entitlements, including means testing. And so it would, by definition, be something that would hit only rich people. And again, it wouldn't raise their tax rates, so, which might disincentivize, you know, them earning more, creating more jobs or whatever. And so that's an idea. And it is interesting that idea, I think that that's, if there is a deal to be cut, if there is a bipartisan deal to be cut, I suspect it will be something similar to what Corker has proposed.
I mean, and is the right embracing Corker right now, or are they mad that he is entertaining any form of revenue increase?
I don't see a lot of embrace or a lot of outrage directed at him. I do suspect that, you know, Grover Norquist from ATR would view that as, you know, people who supported that as breaking the pledge. But I think he could always say, look, we didn't raise taxes. We didn't raise tax rates. We have, you know, these deductions are loopholes and they skew the tax code. And we've simply put a cap on it. Now, there could be unintended consequences to that. I mean, If it hits charitable donations, organizations that rely on major gifts, that could potentially hurt them. There could be all sorts of potential consequences, but I think that that might be the compromise. If there's a deal to be cut, I think it might look like the Corker plan. The other thing, Bill, that's interesting is this idea that's actually been around for a while, but I just sort of paid attention to it recently because there's a Weekly Standard column out just this month from by let's see the guy's name here. The Weekly, it's about William Niskanen, who I was unfamiliar with, but he was a Reaganite who was part of the Cato Foundation and libertarian. And so there's an article about him and his theory, and it's written by Andrew Ferguson at the Weekly Standard, and the theory is that tax cuts, the theory all along, and by the way, others have, this is sort of a new theory to me, but it's been around for years, but I think it's apropos of the discussion we're having right now. The theory going back to even before Reagan was that you could starve the beast, that the only way to cut spending would be to starve government. And so if you cut taxes, you would by definition cut spending. And, Grover Norquist talks about he wanting to get government so small you could drown it in a bathtub. And so the theory is if you raise taxes, you give government more money and they spend it. If you cut taxes, government has less money, you starve the beast. But according to this article and to this theory, which seems to have some statistical validity to it, what actually happens is that Americans, if their taxes are cut, they don't feel the pain that government spending should give them. So in other words, if government spent more and taxes went up accordingly, you would resist government spending. But if spending goes up and taxes come down, what's the problem? What are you going to worry about this sort of ephemeral or ethereal sort of...
This was the Bush-Cheney theory, deficits don't matter.
Budgets don't matter. Deficits don't matter. So the theory is it's quite ironic, but and I equated in my Daily Caller piece, Bill, if you were a drunk or a drug addict, sometimes you have to sort of you have to hit rock bottom before you'll get help. And it may be that Republicans are actually playing the role of enablers by protecting the public, the taxpayer, from feeling the pain that they should feel when spending goes up. I'm not endorsing the theory, but let me just say this, Bill. I'm not endorsing tax hikes, but what I do believe is that if that theory is right, the Corker plan is a bad idea because capping deductions would hit the rich, would do nothing to make the average American feel the pain of spending. What you should push for is comprehensive tax reform and across-the-board flat tax. That would solve the problem. Of course, that's not going to happen anytime soon.
A lot of things I want to say in response to that, but first about the Ferguson thing. I mean, look, I think Republicans tried in this election to accomplish stage two of Starve the Beast. Stage one was the Bush tax cuts, or stage one was Reagan, but that tax of 86 really kind of shuffled things around. It wasn't so much of a as big of a net tax cut for the wealthy as the Bush tax cuts were, and of course the Clinton tax raises were in the middle. So here you have Bush doing the big tax cuts in the 2000s, and the idea was once you reach chasing differences don't matter, I assume, was more of a political argument than an economic one, saying we're not going to suffer any political consequences from increased deficits in the short run, but a time will, there'll be a budget day of reckoning at some point, and if we have embedded in the political culture that any tax increase is political suicide, and this is the Grover theory and the whole Starve the Beast theory, that the political system will have no choice but to cut spending at that juncture. And you had in this campaign, you know, across the entire Republican field, the famous question, would you do a 10-to-1 spending kind of tax increase deal? No Republican would take it. Romney made the argument in the campaign, the problem is spending. We don't need more tax increases. My tax rate is fair. All that stuff. And the problem was that they lost that argument. So now you're at a point where you're at the was perceived to be a day of reckoning. Some people on the left reject that notion, but that still is the general perception out there. And the public is quite comfortable with tax increases at least happening to somebody else, maybe not themselves,
right.
but at least to somebody else.
But I think, Bill, that sort of proves the point here, because the public isn't worried about tax hikes because they haven't felt the pain. I mean, what if Republicans said, we oppose tax hikes, but you have spoken and you have elected Barack Obama and he wants to raise taxes. And so that, you know, and obviously that can't happen because we have members of Congress who are elected, you know, by certain constituencies and they've pledged to not raise taxes and they should honor the pledge. They shouldn't do it. But my point is there's no consequence, right? The public doesn't feel the pain. And so what happens is conservatives, Republicans basically say, we believe that tax cuts are good, and we believe that spending cuts are good, and we want both. But they only get the former, they don't get the latter, so they say, well, maybe a half a loaf is better than nothing. We'll take the tax cuts because they are a good. We didn't get the spending cuts, but we got half. Well, it turns out it could be that half a loaf is worse than none. Because the public doesn't have to pay for the spending. If the public had to pay for the spending, maybe they would become more conservative. Maybe they would then realize that spending is bad and tax hikes are bad. But we have not allowed them to experience this displeasure. We have shielded them. Republicans have in a sense acted as enablers.
Well, the Republicans have had a hard time. Well, there's a connection that has to be made if you're gonna win with that argument that I think Republicans have shied away from. I mean, people generally hate spending in the abstract, but when you talk about specific spending cuts, they say, "Whoa, wait a second, that part of it might actually help me. Don't touch that." You get to a point in these discussions where you got to specify what the cuts are and make the case that they're good, that the individual cuts are good cuts. And if you can't do that, then you're not going to win when the rubber hits the road. Democrats have been very successful saying, you know, the whole Obama argument was balance cuts. Let's cut the things we don't need or can't afford right now. But these things are important. You know, infrastructure is important. Environment's important. Medicare is important. Education's important. And let's find some other things out there that are less so.
You're making a point that I sort of agree with. I think that the idea that we've dumbed down politics is, and you know, here's something, speaking of Republican consultants, here's what they will tell you. The public, it's not that they're dumb, they just don't have that much time. And so keep it simple, don't get into the weeds. Well, I think that was true at one point, but I think that the public is becoming more sophisticated. You have to give more details. And Bill Clinton did a very good job of that at the convention. But here's where I disagree with you, Bill. Because having said all of that, I still believe that a lot of politics is gut. And so here's how human nature works, right? Winston Churchill wins World War II. Then they don't need him anymore, so they vote him out. Think of how bad things used to be like in New York City and in the 1970s in big cities. Crime was a horrible problem. They needed these tough law and order Republicans. So they... You know, the public was scared, and they wanted someone to protect them. And they were afraid of the Soviet Union, and they wanted someone tough to protect them. And so they turned to Republicans. Well, once the problem was solved, once, you know, it seemed to go away, then they could start worrying about Maslow's hierarchy, you know, like something different, right? They'd fulfilled their base needs, and now they want self-actualization. Well, that's my theory here, essentially. Which is to say that they don't appreciate Republicans and conservatives' policies because they haven't been Republicans haven't allowed them to feel the fear, the pain, and so rather than fighting it, maybe a little jujitsu, let Obama have his way. How are you gonna like them apples then?
Well, I made this case in the Bush years. you know, when I was on, you know, the radio back then and writing on my blog back then, I would say, look, Democrats should not be handmaidens to Bush and, you know, and have the blood on their hands for the Bush tax cuts. They shouldn't vote for his nominees, all that stuff. But you don't have to filibuster everything. I mean, I say filibuster things that you can't undo. You know, I would say, you know, you go to the mat on a Supreme Court nomination because you can't fix that once they're there. But for tax cuts or for other policy things, you can say, I'm going to vote against it. I'm going to argue against it. I'm not going to be for it, but I'm not going to stop you from getting it. Let it happen. The public voted for it. This is what you wanted. Here it is. You can see how well it works. You can say if you want to keep it 2, 4, 6, 8 years from now. I think that's what you're saying too. You're not saying Republicans have to bless it and embrace it and love it, but it can. You don't have to filibuster it. You can say let it happen. Let the spending occur. Let the taxes go up on these folks, and you can see if you like that kind of government at the end of the day. Now to do that requires a certain degree of faith that you're going to be right and the public is going to hate it, because if they like it, then they might keep it for a very long time.
That's a good point. And sometimes things that are bad don't manifest for years, and there are a lot of it. Now, or, you know, you started this off, Bill, by asking about the political ramifications. I think that it's too soon to know how or if this could impact the presidential race, but we do see these interesting maneuvering happening already in Virginia. Bill Bowling, more moderate Republican, decided to drop out. So we're going to have Ken Cuccinelli, a much more conservative Republican, probably be the gubernatorial nominee. We see Saxby Chambliss in Georgia, who has seemed to imply he would support some form of raising revenue, come under fire. And the latest is Eric Erickson from Red State and CNN is flirting with the idea of primarying him. Don't know if that's going to happen or if that's fun or serious, but I mean, Erickson would be an incredibly strong candidate.
He would lose all the political capital he now has if he proved that he could even win a freaking primary in Georgia.
Well, there could be consequences. I mean, we've seen people before, Mickey Cowles, William F. Buckley, people who ran for office as sort of protest candidates, and they lost, and they were fine. They were, you know, but they were protest candidates. Erickson would presumably be a legitimate, viable candidate. And by the way, he has been elected before. I think he might even still be.
So he's Macon City Council, right?
There you go. So it's not like he's never been elected to anything, and obviously his national profile. If I were advising him, I would say don't do it. It's bad. It's going to be bad for your career. Good publicity for now, but I think the consequences of losing. But who knows? And maybe he could win and become a U.S. senator. That would be amazing, and it's not an absurd possibility. So we see this. We talked about Chris Christie earlier. I think that in the Senate, people like Corker, I think, are the, you know, Shelley Moore Capito this week said she's going to run against Rockefeller if he runs for re-election in West Virginia. Conservatives like the Club for Growth and Jim DeMint's group coming out saying she's not conservative enough. Other people pushing back. Jerry Moran, the head of the NRSC, pushing back. The Main Street Partnership pushing back. So it's going to be interesting to see. And let's see, how will Shelley Moore Capito? She's in Congress right now. I suspect that she would be more than happy to go along with some sort of tax increase. will that have an impact? It's going to be interesting to watch.
Well, perhaps we should leave it there, Mr. Lewis.
Good place to stop. Good place to stop. I should probably note, I mentioned Ken Cuccinelli. My wife used to work for him. Doesn't now, but years ago did as a consultant. So I should probably mention that just in case.
Very ethical of you, sir.
Try to be avoid any even the appearance of impropriety. good show as always, always good talking to you, I guess we're going to head into the Christmas season. A couple years ago, Bill, we did a show, a very special, the Weekend Blog back then.
Right.
And what did we do? Was it, did we, refresh my memory, I don't know if we took questions from the audience or if we just talked about stuff, about our personal lives. It was a holiday
festival. I think we talked about our blogging history, if I recall. How we got into blogging and all that.
Maybe something along those lines. I mean, not the same thing exactly, but let's I'd love if people want to chime in and weigh in.
What's a good year-end DMZ?
What would be a good, it could be, you know, the last several years I've written a column, things I got wrong. Maybe instead of doing the column, we just talk about what we were wrong about this year. Maybe that's a good New Year's show. But I'm open to suggestions.
Sure. I'm down with any of that.
Very good, man. All right. Well, until next week, we'll see you on in the DMZ.